looking at this first chapter, 1 Corinthians, these concepts that are here are rather momentous. That is, they're rather crucial. So much of Christian ideology or theology is not usable because we don't really get into the meaning of what we're talking about. You can throw these phrases out. For example, it's easy to say Christ is our righteousness. What does it really mean? You know, just words on a page. Very few people are able to really pull that into focus in their daily lives. You can sing Jesus, Thy Blood and Righteousness, and so forth. There's one of the great old hymns of the church. You can sing that, and you can talk about Christ is our peace or Christ is our righteousness. And you try to apply it in life on a daily basis, and it doesn't quite seem to fit the facts of existence. You know, it doesn't come into focus for us very clearly. So for a great many Bible studies, you have nice fantasies, nice stories, nice platitudes or ideas, hang on a wall motto. You can go home and stitch it onto the wall, onto a piece of cloth and hang it on the wall. And it says, great peace of they that love thy law, or something like whatever it is. And then you try to make it work daily in your daily living. Almost seems discontinuous, it seems like there are two different worlds. Go to a Bible class and that's a nice sweet little fantasy world, and then you go home and you hit the egg hits the fan there and things fall apart, and it's a different world. So you just have to put up with this rambling, penetrating discourse, because I'm looking at these words, and I'm not going to leave you in that position of not being able to actually work them into your daily living. So that's why we take a lot of time going over these ideas. We've always done it that way, and in the end, you have some sense of what it's all about. In verse 27, but he has chosen the foolish things of the world to bring to shame the wise, and the weak of the world has God chosen to bring to shame the strong. Paul says, I am not ashamed in respect to the gospel of Christ. That word itself is so vital to you that we need to look at it from a technical point of view and say, just what does it mean to be ashamed? And there are other passages, in Ephesians, for example, where it says, we will not be ashamed at his coming. Now, what does that mean? You have to be concerned about being red-faced when you stand in front of Christ. Well, you find that has nothing to do with being red-faced, nor, of course, in Romans, that passage is used mightily by the people that are given to much public expression of witnessing and so forth, and these people use it to say, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, which means I'm not embarrassed to go up and say something about Christ. Well, that gives a very petty twist to the whole idea. When you find out the real deep meaning of the word, as you see it here, what it really does is give us great comfort, great help that you can take with you when you go home and the egg hits the fan. The word is from eskuo, which means to be able or to be strong. Onto this word eskuo is a particle, an alpha or a in Greek, which means not. And in front of that is a preposition kata, which means utterly, completely. It's used to the word with the word rust to mean eaten completely up or utterly down through. The words put together like that means that we will not be without strength at all. We will be completely not without strength. That is to say that when we stand before God, we will not be without support. We will be strong. and not without. So when Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, he's really saying the gospel does not leave me in the lurch without any support. When he says we will not be ashamed at his coming, it means we will have support, strength. Now in this passage in 1 Corinthians, he's saying that the foolish things of the world really in a lot of ways show up the utter lack of substance of the wise things of the world. You got a question, David?
The gospel has substance to it, and therefore I'm not going to be support because it's
Yeah, for it is the gospel does have the proclamation is a substantive proclamation that gives him the support. He says, I'm not ashamed, but that is, I'm not without support on the basis of the gospel, that is, on the footing of the gospel. The gospel is the foundation that gives me the strength, for it is the power of God unto salvation. The gospel, the evangelion, the proclamation of God, gives him a platform of strength. Now, I hope all of you can sense the deep impact here of the idea that in Christ himself is the substance of our faith, and it does not depend upon our ability to grasp it, to make it work, so to speak. It's there already. We go back now and pick up the loose ends. Verse 26, for you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise after the flesh, not many do not toy, that is mighty from the point of view of authority or position, not many well-born, but the foolish things of the world has God chosen in order that he may make ashamed the wise, that is, in order to mean he may show up the lack of foundation that the wise have. Now, of course, that meant something in this part of the world because, as I've pointed out several times, we're talking about a very sophisticated society who put a lot of weight on their knowledge, their wisdom. And wisdom here doesn't mean the capacity to make a good choice about something. Wisdom is something the Bible encourages in us. We're talking here about those who are the wise men of the philosophical process there. And it would be an identifiable group, the pundits, the, I hesitate to say scholars because it's not quite the feeling. You can be a scholar and still not be classified as the wise men here. But these were men who thought they knew all there was, thought they knew a lot, and made a... they focused on the accumulation of the knowledge of humanity. They focused on that, knowledge for knowledge's sake, rather than simple wisdom. A person can have a lot of wisdom, has no education at all. But this is not that kind of wisdom. That other would be discretion, perhaps. This is a concept that focuses on knowledge for knowledge's sake. Kant wrote his book, The Critique of Pure Reason, and another, The Critique of Pure Knowledge, in which he was discussing the idea of just knowledge for its own sake and not for application of other things. I don't want to tarry too long on that. He's taken the foolish things of the world to show up the wise. Whatever your station in life, whatever your level of achievement, whatever your capacities intellectually, physically, the one thread that runs through all humanity, that is those who want to participate in it, is the strength of Christ, the redemption of Christ, the power of Christ to fulfill the purposes of God in the world, the power of Christ to carry us through. I think it's just so essential to understand that whatever may be your inadequacies or conflicts currently or your failures or whatever else it is, that the thread of divine strength and power runs through all of them. So I've talked about situations of people who have been handicapped physically, and I've said, well, your body is handicapped, but your spirit isn't. By the same token, we have mental handicaps. This is why it takes me so long to get through these verses, because there's so many intricate implications to the matter of human personality and character. You can't just take a room full of Christians and say that everybody is suddenly lovely and great, you know, and victorious and all the rest of it. You see, on the surface, maybe they all talk like it, but again, we're talking about what happens when the egg hits the fan. I try to open up these subjects. Mentally, we have all of us certain handicaps. You may not believe that, but I'm going to tell you that that's true. Restrictions. Now, these restrictions are based upon hereditary factors. There are certain traits, character traits. In the years that I've worked in counseling with a great many thousands of people by now, in these years, I have come to the conclusion that there are certain traits that get passed along that some people just are going to have to struggle with all their lives. They may be wonderful people, but for example, a matter of handling money. Some people just have a genetic background or an hereditary factor. They're just always going to have trouble handling money. That doesn't mean they can't budget and pay their bills and so forth. They're just better walk a pretty close line there because, if they try to get off into business matters or make business deals, no matter what the deal is, they come up short. There are some people, no matter what the deal is, they come out on the long end of the stick. They just seem to fall into it, into business matters. Some people just aren't business people. There are different kinds of handicaps like that. We have handicaps that have to do with persecution complex. Some people always think people are talking about them or don't like them or whatever. It's probably a trait, genetic trait. Some people have a sort of a selfish streak in them, akin to what we call autism. The autistic person is an autistic child, which we have talked about a lot in recent years in the circles of psychiatric inanity. Which means they don't know anything, but they say a lot. We've had some very recent disappointment in that field as far as our evaluation of certain characters in this country. There are studies in the field of autism where the word autism comes from the Greek word autos, which means self. An autistic child is a child that is so totally self-oriented as to be non-functional, sometimes completely non-functional, or not functional in normal ways in society. Now, that autism, that self-orientation, may take the form of total withdrawal. So an autistic child could crouch in the corner and not ever talk or ever come out. It could take the form of antisocial behavior, which gives no thought whatever to anything around them other than their own particular desires or interests or wants or expressions. So thus an autistic child will act discourteously. Now you may think of your own child now and say, well, I wonder, but this is to or your husband or wife. No, but this is to a fault where the child is uncontrollable. They go around kicking everybody in the shins and knocking stuff over and speaking out of turn and so forth. So totally incorrigibly or uncontrollably that there's a total selfness here that regards not in any way anybody else around. Now, when you take that fundamental trait and you modify it down the line and say that there are people who do have difficulty with a totally self-oriented attitude toward life, whether some people you know, not yourselves, of course. I mean, I'm talking now about those not in our group. not so much maliciously, but vacuously disinterested in anybody else but themselves. It's whatever they want that is the fundamental issue of society. Everything in the household has to revolve around that person in their mind. And they grow up into adulthood with that kind of a feeling, and these are totally self-centered people. It can be a character trait. It doesn't mean it shouldn't ever be controlled, and it will lose friends fast when you get out into that hard, cold world where nobody has to put up with you. You lose on that kind of a basis. You don't try to work some corralling factor here. And these are restrictive things in our minds that we've got to handle those things. We can be in trouble. Environment produces some of these things in our mind, way we were brought up and so forth. Controlling our attitude toward life and things. And one of the greatest ways for a human being to recognize that potential problem is to walk softly among people and say, maybe I'm not always right, you know. maybe there is something wrong with me too, you know. It's hard to believe, hard to imagine. When in a lot of counseling, marriage counseling, of course, you've got two different ways in which people come at the problem of marriage. The first thing that most people want to talk about is what's wrong with the other person. When maybe the first place to start is what's wrong with me, then we'll extend that to see what's wrong with the other person. Because what you are may be what has made them what they are. People react to people differently, I should say. You may be familiar with the idea that perfume reacts differently depending on the body chemistry. I don't think it's only a particular brand of perfume that does that, though there are brands that are highly advertised as being your own special brand because it blends with your own body chemistry and gives you your own peculiar scent, we'll say, scent of odor. But that's probably true of all perfume. So one person married to another person, one will be different married to one person than they will married to another person. That's true of all human relationships. There's a mix here where there's a variable. The same person will react differently to one person than another person. And some people, as you know, of course, it's a truism. Some people bring out the worst in people. Some people bring out the best in them. And that gets switched, you know. Under certain conditions, some people bring out the worst and some bring out the best. What does all of it really mean? It means walk softly, you know. It means the whole process of human relationships is a tricky thing, and it's not something you can nail down. And the more you are convinced that you are the right one and that you are the good one and so on, the more likely you are to be off base. You get warped in that. So you say, well, you know, maybe there are some things wrong with me. Maybe I'm not the world's greatest person to live with. Maybe I'm partly responsible for the way the other person behaves because of the way I've treated them. Maybe with another person, they would be quite different. Maybe I've brought out the worst in them. Those are wholesome thoughts because, you know, they help you to be modest about life and yourself and to walk softly. Modify relationships so that you can live together at peace. Very little marriage counseling would be needed if both parties would determine that they want to do what's best for the whole group and for the other person and what Christ wants. That's why I don't often see people together, married couples, if they want to come for counseling. I don't see them together because each one of them is sitting there trying to get me to be on their side, and if I'm not, they're disappointed, you know. If I take the other person's side, it's not easy. I remember one situation. It was in a professional setting that this couple came with. The husband was, he was an alcoholic, and his wife, of course, was devastated by the whole thing. But anyway, we're sitting there together. He wants to get hold of the problem, and they want to work it out. So she's sitting there telling me all the good things she's done and that she's never taken a drink in her life and she's done this and she's done that, you know. And I just turned to him and I said, it must be awfully tough living with such a good woman, you know. And but that's the spirit of thing. Maybe with another kind of woman, he wouldn't have gone to alcohol. After I got her out of the room, you know, I made a little deal with him. I said, if you'll stay off the booze, I'll get her off your back. How's that? And he agreed to that, so I laid it out to her pretty straight about it, and I said, I want you to talk any more to him about it. Just don't say another word. Just forget it. Let him go out and do whatever he wants to. She agreed to that, and she took it for about 2 weeks, and that was all she could take of keeping her mouth shut. So then she went back to her old nagging, and he went back to the booze. He was completely off the booze for 2 weeks. She went back to nagging. He went back to the booze, and that's the way the whole thing finally dissipated. The point is that if she had not seen herself as such a marvelous person, maybe she thought maybe she has a few faults too, and maybe she ought to just be a little more gracious. Now, of course, I understand alcohol creates so many tough problems, and it's hard to keep still. We do far better to keep still about these things. If it would help to put pressure on the other person, I would say to do it, but it doesn't help. Now, all of this in the direction of when we try to shape up other people, you see, you know, a lot of our problems come from trying to shape up others. Now, you may wonder what this has to do with the text. Well, it has a lot to do with it, because I'm trying to show you the kinds of problems that human personalities face with themselves and with others. I'm trying to say, given all of the limitations of the mind through heredity and environmental processes and so forth, given all these things, maybe we ought to just kind of walk graciously among people and be kind of less quick to judge and maybe be a little more generous about their problems, knowing that we have our own problems, and knowing also this fundamental fact, they might be a different person if you hadn't married them, you know. You might be a lot better person. You know, you don't go and commit suicide over it, but you just say, well, maybe we ought to all just sort of live together and hope for the best and not be too hard on one another. Now, again, we're talking about the fact that human beings have these restrictions, these handicaps, not only physically, but we have handicaps mentally. We are limited in how we understand things. We're limited in our actions, limited in our attitudes. All these things are limited, and it's hard to put all the pieces together and be a really together person. We'd like to be together persons, you know. We'd like to have our head together. But it's tough, and we don't really get the job done ere we shuffle off this mortal coil. You know, we don't really accomplish it. We work at it, but we don't accomplish it. But how nice it would be just sort of to live together and accept that point. They got faults, I've got faults. We're going to just try to enjoy one another's company rather than trying to shape each other up. The sculpturing of human personality is a thankless task. And if you have a chisel in hand and you're trying to do that, I suggest you put the chisel away and be a little more at peace about the way they are. You know, it comes down in a way to the point of which is more important, have a person that you can live with, some human being to come home to or to be with that is company, or to have a paragon of virtue that you've turned into an ogre, you know, by your hammering and chiseling. Best to just kind of be at peace with one another and enjoy being together, because otherwise you just alienate people all around. You alienate husbands, wives, children by just this big old flapping lips here. This is what you alienate people with. Again, let me come back to it and say this. Were it not for the substantive presence of the Spirit of Christ in our spirits, we would be in bad shape. And yet, because of the presence of the Spirit of Christ within us, the personality problems and living situational problems that we confront constantly, because of His presence in us, are only moderately crucial. By moderately crucial, I mean this. If you don't ever get your act together, you'll probably still be in the family of Christ. You'll still be saved, you know, going through. But if you don't get your act together, you may have a few bruises by the time you get there. You may be riding alone. People don't have to respond to you graciously and generously. You hope they will, but they don't have to. And it may be that people scat out on you. A lot of times parents who are decrying the fact that their young people never come around or don't like them or so on and so on and so on, maybe they've come by that naturally. Maybe they've earned their solitude by their ineptitude and cussedness. Parents can be spoiled brats too, you know, because they demand this and insist on that.
you don't love me because you didn't get to see me Christmas Day, and how come your birthday card said only I love you and not I love you dearly, why did you do this and why did you do that and so forth. Mainly though, it's because that over the years the parents have exercised their divine rights of parenthood and so badgered the poor youth that they don't want to see them again into their house. I've seen this happen in the weeks or perhaps months before a marriage, before a wedding. The mother and daughter are battering away at each other so much that by the time the wedding takes place, the kids scat out of there and they don't ever want to see them again. But we have only ourselves to blame. But then again, I'm going to have to say, there are people that are in the Lord's family that are Christians, or one or the other doesn't even care at all. They don't think they're out of order at all, and you can't make them think that. And they just go on acting the way they're acting, and they don't want anybody to tell them what to do. They're not even trying. Where two people are trying to do what's right, trying to get their act together, if they can just give each other space, just say, yeah, I realize I've got this fault. I'm trying to work it out. We have to give them space. They may not get it worked out, but is that, really all that much of a crime? As long as they're trying. As far as intent is concerned, people do things and they don't have, there isn't the slightest intention to do that. It's a thing they do because they get careless or they forget. People forget things. And you never can fault somebody whose intentions are good, but they just forgot or they made a mistake. We all make mistakes. I think of that when you're out driving there, and you cut somebody off, and they honk the horn angrily, and they're all upset. And I just ask myself, I wonder if they ever made a mistake. Did they ever do that? Sure, I've done that plenty of times. So why get upset with somebody else who does it? See? Paul hit it when he said, you're inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art, the judgest, for in that you judge another, you yourself do the same things. It's shocking to me how true that is. You read that and you think, well, that's a pretty strong statement. And you find it's true. Here's some parent very upset with their young person, talking to me about, I can't understand why my young person does this and this, and I know they've done the same thing. I don't mean when they're kids, I mean now. And we expect more of our young people than we do of ourselves often. See? All of it comes under that one label, that it's difficult for human beings to put their act together. And if you've got two Christian people that are trying to put it together and doing their best, but they make mistakes, they're faulty, they may have, maybe there's a certain hereditary pattern here, they're probably not going to change. I was dealing with a couple recently, a young woman, and we're talking about reconciliation. I said, now here are some things that I think are not going to change. Can you live with this? It's all right, see? So here they were, one, two, three. I said, these things are probably factors in this person's life that will not change. Maybe they should change. But I think there's an hereditary factor here, and I think there are other factors that they're not going to change. Maybe you're just going to have to accept that and appreciate the fact that you've got somebody to live with and not to be alone, you see. Maybe that's more important. It is not to excuse anyone from behaving themselves, because there's no excuse. I mean, the sense that if we misbehave, we're going to hurt for misbehaving. If we don't do right, we don't do well, people will not be our friends anymore. We'll lose the affection of husbands or wives or children because we act like that. We may have every excuse in the world. We may say, well, I was born that way, or I'm working hard, or whatever else. You have the excuse, yes, but you alienate the affection, see? Now, that's not to read you out of the kingdom of God. It's going to say you may be alone. if you act rotten to people, you'll be alone. If you want to be alone, go ahead, act rotten. There are many reasons to put lives in order, keep things going on an even keel. But none of these reasons say that if you don't do it, you're going to be thrown out of the kingdom. And that's why I'm saying when it says here, for example, that Christ is our righteousness, which it says at the end of this chapter, it is really saying that when we've been brought into the fold, when we brought into the kingdom of Christ, that we still bring with us a very large bag of tricks, the problems, character problems, personality problems, so on. We still bring those in with us. And we may not shed all of them, but we're still members of his family, nevertheless. And he cares about us, loves us. And if you can just think of yourselves as a large family where there's this one that does this thing out of order and this one does that thing out of order, and they shout at each other and they jump up and down and they get excited and, about life and so forth, but they're all still children in the family. As they grow up and as they mature, they modulate a little bit. They modify their behavior as they learn the penalty for carelessness. Kids get out of the house into the school situation or into the workaday world. They find that their behavior is not going to be accepted and they're going to hurt for it even more. If they get crossways with people at the office, they're going to be blackballed, you know, and so forth. What a marvelous thing to realize that fools though we be, and weak and human and failing and all the rest of it, that Christ is our righteousness and our salvation and security is not in our ability to be good, but in our being a member of the family. It isn't even in our ability to hang on to Christ, because he hangs on to us. That's a glorious thing.